Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Hancock & Whitney Bank's post-election analysis. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or any of its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to emile.curry, that's E-M-I-L-E dot curry, K-O-U-R-Y, at hancockbank.com, and we will take those questions at the end of the call. Today I have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, and Emile Curry will be our guest moderator for the call. He is a financial planner with our private banking department, and he holds his CPA and CFP. And with that, I'm going to hand the call over to Emile.
Thank you, Ashley. I think what we'll do is start with just a very brief and quick overview of the election. As you know, I hope you all know, Tuesday we had the presidential election, and President Barack Obama was reelected for a second term. The Electoral College, Obama received 303 electoral votes. Romney received 206, and of course, Florida is being recounted. President Obama received he edged out Romney by a 2% margin on the popular vote. In the Senate, the Democrats have 53 seats, the Republicans 45, and the Independents 2, with the Republicans losing 2 seats there. And in the House, the Republicans still control the House, but could lose up to 6 seats in the House. So basically, we're right where we started from before this election from the last 4 years, with the Democrats picking up a couple seats in the Senate, which was unexpected. So at this point, I want to turn to John and ask him to give us his opinion on the results of this past presidential election.
In terms of history, we saw some things during this election cycle that we haven't seen in many, many years. In fact, we haven't seen anything quite like it since the Great Depression of the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And in that case, instance, I guess, you know, thinking back about history, it was probably surprising that President Obama was reelected. Obviously, you had the Affordable Care Act that a large portion of the country did not like. He really did not have a plan to improve growth or job creation. No particular plan was really put forth during a great deal of the election cycle. And high unemployment, declining real wages, you know, certainly a downer as far as reelecting any president would be concerned. And then the campaign itself, you know, from President Obama's side was extraordinarily negative and divisive. And again, you really haven't seen anything like that really since the 1930s during the Depression years when Franklin Roosevelt was running for election. Now, while the outcome may have been surprising in terms of more recent history, given the things I just mentioned, it was not particularly surprising to us because, as many of you know, we're quantitative managers, and so we tend to gravitate toward quantitative solutions and quantitative analyses as far as a lot of things are concerned. And in the case of this particular election, the quantitative data never really gave Romney a significant probability of winning the election. I think in terms of one particular quant process that I'm familiar with and followed fairly closely, his chances of winning were never greater than maybe 35 or 40%, and a few days before the election the odds were something like 83 or 85% in favor of President Obama being reelected. So we didn't think that was particularly surprising. That was sort of what we expected. However, what was somewhat surprising was the breadth of the win. The results weren't quite as tight as everybody had expected. Apparently, you had a turnout by women and millennials. That would be the 18 to 25-year-old crowd, that particular generational unit that was not really expected, I suppose, by the Republicans, and I don't think anybody really expected the turnout to be that significant. One interesting thing about the millennials that, in my opinion, I certainly hope is not true, is that some have suggested this particular group are more accepting of government control as far as their their direction of their lives they are concerned. And someone wrote a book recently saying that the millennial generation sort of looked on government as a parent. Now, a lot of us on this call, besides us, probably find that somewhat appalling, but nevertheless, that sort of analysis has been thrown out there, indicating that, maybe this election had a significance far beyond, what we might have thought beforehand. So surprisingly poor outcome for the Senate, too, of course, which added to the, the concern about what this particular election might represent. And at the bottom line, I guess, here is that, you begin to wonder if we have reached a tipping point towards some sort of version of the European welfare state, and there's not going to be much going back if the demographics suggest that some of the younger people in society are in favor of that kind of governmental environment. So we'll see, I suppose, but it's hard to make sweeping, and we should avoid making sweeping judgments, I guess, after something like this. But nevertheless, that does suggest that, something has changed in the electorate, and probably has been changing for a number of years. And this probably, just brings that home. And we can talk some more later about what that might suggest for, the economy and the markets going forward. So I'll stop here, and we'll just move on.
All right, John. Every time you turn on the news now, you're hearing about the country is about to fall off the fiscal cliff. This is a two-part question. One, John, what exactly is the fiscal cliff? And secondly, can you discuss some of the more important tax provisions that will affect our high net worth clients that are set to expire or change in 2013?
Just to remind everybody what the fiscal cliff is all about, and I'm sure we all know, we've read about it quite a bit. For a number of months, it means essentially that all of the Bush tax cuts that went into effect in 2003 will be repealed automatically unless some legislation is passed to, amend that. And the 15% tax on dividends will revert to an ordinary tax rate, which in this case, could be as high as 39.6%, given what the old tax rates were like. Capital gains taxes could run from 15% to 20%. Standard income tax rate, maximum 35% rate, would return back to a 39.6% rate. So everybody is focused on the fiscal cliff. Part of the market decline the other day that was fairly severe, a little over 300 points, probably related to a renewed focus on the fiscal cliff and what that might mean. Right now, we think there's probably a better than even chance, maybe as high as 75-80%, that most of the fiscal cliff will be avoided, because neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, and certainly not any of us or any of the businesses in the country, are looking forward to a automatic return to tax rates that would probably drive the economy down by 3 or 4 percentage points in the early part of next year. So, we think there's a fairly good chance that that will be avoided. However, there probably is a curb out there, maybe not a cliff, but a curb. And there are some taxes going into effect that are related to the Affordable Care Act concerning taxes on unearned income and some other things that will probably, and return of a full tax on FICA, for example. Social Security tax is probably not going to be reduced anymore, and we'll go back to a standard, tax there that probably will take maybe, 0.8% or 1% out of GDP according to current estimates. One reason too that the market probably dropped as much as it did the other day after the election was because Wall Street has long believed that a Romney win would be more friendly. And let's say more supportive of a quick resolution of the fiscal cliff compared to what would happen if Obama was reelected. So I think the market is guessing that there might be a little more friction involved in the discussions before some sort of compromise is reached, about the fiscal cliff. But our present guess as is everybody else's guess, is that most of this will be resolved before the end of the year, but there'll be some drag on GDP going forward into next year.
And I'd like to comment on one, it's kind of a new tax that we really didn't discuss. It's the 3.8% Medicare surtax on net investment income. That would affect taxpayers that file jointly with a modified adjusted gross income of $250 and more or more, or single taxpayers that file and have over $200,000 income. So it's a potential tax on net investment income, which would include dividends, interest, and capital gains. So we're not going to give specific tax advice, but just be aware that it's out there. It's a potential tax on net investment income for the $250 and above and married filing joint and $200 and above on the single filers.
Oh, something else I should mention, too, about the resolution of the fiscal cliff to give everybody an idea of what's currently being talked about in Washington based on the data we're getting from various research sources, and that is that some sort of compromise might be reached. And then, again, this is just casual conversation that apparently has been overheard in Washington, that taxes might go up for married couples who make more than $750,000 a year. You know, kind of a compromise that would allow the fiscal cliff to be avoided and for some agreement to occur that would extend, you know, the current tax rates for most people, you know, into the coming year until some more detailed work can be done on long-term tax rates.
All right, John, thank you. Next question. With the re-election of President Obama, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, seems a certainty now. John, give us your thoughts on this act.
Well, the act was, as we all know, created in a rather chaotic atmosphere, you know, one in which probably not all the people who voted for it even knew what was in it. And, you know, we've heard that talked about quite a bit, and probably not that many people have read the act in its entirety. But we already see certain groups and companies being exempted for one reason or another, and I imagine there will be some more adjustments made as we go forward before the act is really underway in 2014. The thing that nobody really knows or understands at this point is how chaotic and costly this thing is going to be. You know, it's a massive involvement of the government in something like, 1/12, I guess, is it, or perhaps more than that, of the economy. So there are going to be some difficulties surrounding this as it gets underway. And the cost will, as we all know, be considerably more than anyone has estimated. Also, you're going to have to get ready for, obviously, at some point, price controls and or a rationing of health care in some fashion. So, I mean, this is certainly what's happened in Canada. It's happened in the UK, anywhere else in the world that has been tried. And so, you know, these are things that will probably, you know, create some, you know, some difficulty for the economy as we you know, begin to try to adjust to the new reality. Did we mention the medical device taxes? Maybe we didn't.
No.
That goes into effect in 2013. There's a tax on medical devices. You know, not that medical devices necessarily need to be taxed, but they had to find money someplace. So in this bill, there's a tax on on companies that make medical devices. That's another item that adds to the, you know, 1% or so, give or take, drag that everybody is looking for next year, even if the fiscal cliff is avoided.
All right, John. In early 2013, the new Congress will have to pass a new debt ceiling limit. Will you comment on how that will work and also how it interrelates with our deficit, current deficit?
Well, you know, periodically the debt ceiling has to be raised because we're operating at a deficit, and the deficit continues to move higher. You know, if the debt ceiling is not raised, then the government, in effect, you know, theoretically comes to a halt. Although it's not necessarily, you know, always the case. They can get around some of these things if the debt ceiling is not raised. But that's coming up around March. So besides the fiscal cliff, we've got to worry about all of the conversation and conflict about increasing the debt ceiling early next year. U.S. credit rating is at stake here. The credit rating agencies have suggested that if the debt ceiling is not resolved fairly quickly, that it could impact our credit rating. And then, of course, there's the other factor out there, you know, concerning a long-term, you know, arrangement that might, you know, work toward alleviating our deficit over time. And we just have to see how that works out. But you know, a lot of things coming up that are going to create, you know, some anxiety, I guess, in the markets.
Okay. With the re-election of President Obama, can you give us your opinion on what's going to happen to Chairman Bernanke, whose term expires in February of 2014?
Well, Bernanke has said he wants to retire. At least that's what the word going around the business is, that he wants to not exactly retire, but step out of that job in 2014 when his time is up. Obama will be president then, of course, and we'll appoint someone else. There's no reason to expect that it won't be someone that's probably similar to Bernanke in tone and substance. So we're not really looking for any particularly significant change in the Fed at that point. Some people suggest that when Bernanke leaves, that you know, President Obama's pick to for that job is likely to be someone who believes similarly as Bernanke that, you know, low interest rates and easy money is probably something that needs to be continued for some time. Of course, it's going to depend on what happens to the economy by that point, but we don't expect that there's going to be a significant, you know, increase in economic activity for a while. So we're probably still looking at low interest rates and a relatively easy Fed, even in February of 2014.
Thank you, John. Have we reached a point where our leaders can't kick the can down the road again in regards to the debt and deficit? And will our leaders be forced to make tough decisions and come up with some type of grand bargain?
That's really the big question. Everybody argues about that and speculates about it every day. On the one hand, you have economists who are urging politicians and urging, you know, people like Bernanke to maintain an easy money stance for a very long time to try to, and government spending for a very long time, to try to offset the fact that in the private economy, everybody's trying to repair their balance sheets and save more. And so if everybody saves at the same time, of course, you have something that's called the paradox of thrift, which is somewhat negative for the economy. And at the present time, to offset that, it looks like government spending is the only answer. On the other side, you've got people who argue that spending too much money now simply increases the deficit and produces more debt that's going to have to be paid later and really postpones the issue and really creates greater problems down the line. Obviously, for, you know, those of us who believe, you know, the correct answer, I guess, to get us out of this with a moderate amount of pain is somewhere in the middle, where you have some attempt to raise revenue and you have some easy money policies and you know, you rejigger the tax code, you change it to make it more effective and efficient, and at least provide some measure of prospect for growth going forward. But there's a pretty big divide there among economists about, you know, what is the best tack to take. You know, we think a compromise is better. Something was tried with the Simpson-Bowles deal a year or so back, and that sort of died, and I'm sure something like that will probably try to be, gathered together to use as a template for something going forward. But you have to wonder at this point, you know, how much compromise, you know, there will be, and that of course is the real question. So, you know, again, that's something that we just don't really know at this point. But you know, we certainly hope it's something that gets resolved with an idea that, you know, we're going to, you know, try to grow our way out of this to some degree, rather than simply you know, trying to raise taxes and spend money at the same time. And that's probably not going to work very well. So, you know, we'll just see. We don't know at this point. It's you know, we can hope, but chances are it's going to be more difficult for us to arrive at an agreement in the near term than anybody thinks. And politicians generally tend to, you know, not really react until we see a crisis. And, you know, down the road, of course, we will have one if we don't come to a compromise fairly soon and at least start working toward a resolution of that situation. But in any case, it's one of those things where we just have to wait and see.
Okay. Well, John, now that the election's been decided, can you comment on the macroeconomic impact and the impact on overall financial markets?
That probably requires going back in time a little bit and the bursting of the technology bubble in 2000. And, you know, following, you know, that event, you know, we speculated that we had entered a secular bear market, one of those periods in which stocks move from a severely overvalued position to neutral and then eventually to undervalued. And during this transition period, you tend to have a sideways movement in the major market indices. You don't have much progress on the upside. You just simply have a long consolidation and a lot of different cycles. We've had that now for about 13 years. Stocks now are not as expensive as they were during the technology bubble, so we're on our way to resolving the valuation situation. Unfortunately, real GDP growth, that's, you know, GDP growth adjusted for inflation, has been less than 2% on average for the last 10 years. And, you know, we've been used to 3% growth in the past. It now looks like that 2% plus or minus situation is something that represents, I guess, the new normal, as the PIMCO people have talked about. And that may be with us for a while. So, you know, how do we get out of this? It probably just going to take a lot of time. And, you know, our concern now is with the re-election of President Obama and the likelihood or I guess the supposition that we may have reached the tipping point as far as a European welfare state type trend is concerned, that's going to make it even more difficult to generate growth in the future that we might need to, you know, help grow our way out of this debt and deficit problem. You know, again, this is a long-term issue that won't be resolved for quite some time, but it suggests to me that the 2% plus or minus growth is probably somewhat baked in the cake now for a number of years, if indeed we have slipped toward the European welfare state form of government with a lot of sustenance, you know, going to a large portion of the population. Again, that's just a guess at this point because we really don't know exactly how the future is going to unfold. But it suggests to me more and more that that 2% GDP growth trend that we've been in for quite some time is likely to continue for a number of years in the future. The implication here, of course, is we'll have higher taxes. You know, higher taxes will tend to suppress the growth rate. Higher taxes tend to suppress price earnings multiples on stocks. So stock returns and bond returns and generally risk asset returns are lower in that kind of environment, relatively lower than they would be ordinarily. Now, you know, does the election suggest that the situation is worse than what we were talking about before? Well, no, not really. I mean, if it looks like we're still in the 2% growth world. We're in a 2% growth world, and it just may be more difficult for us to get out of it. It may take longer for us to work through this than we had thought about before. So in that respect, I guess nothing has really changed from our standpoint. As far as valuation is concerned for common stocks, for example, valuation is sort of on the low side of neutral now, having been extremely good at the depths of the recession in 2008, early 2009. Now we've come back a great deal, and under a moderate growth forecast, the current level of current valuation of stocks, again, looking at the major market indices, you know, not individual companies, but the major market indices, suggests that you probably got a 5 to 6% return expectation going forward, say, for the next 10 years. And, you know, these numbers are based on historical examples of valuation estimates that have worked reasonably well in the past. Now, compared to bonds, where you're talking about 2 or 3% on taxable bonds, you know, given current yield levels, that's pretty attractive. It's not what we've been used to in the past in terms of projecting in the past, obviously, in terms of what we would like to see from the markets. But nevertheless, from, you know, from a historic standpoint, that's what the suggested future looks like, which to us means you still have to concentrate on industries and sectors and, you know, be fairly selective about the investments that you make in this kind of environment. Getting back to the fiscal cliff, if we go off the fiscal cliff, then you're probably going to have a pretty sharp reaction in the market. Again, we don't think that's necessarily what's going to happen, but even if we don't go off the fiscal cliff and we step off the curb that we've talked about that might, you know, result in, say, a, you know, let's just call it a half of 1% to maybe a 1% decline in real GDP, it suggests that the stock market will have a difficulty, you know, making a lot of progress, you know, over the next, you know, 6 months or so. It doesn't necessarily say that we're going to have a big decline, but it probably, you know, puts a ceiling on any increase from here as far as the markets are concerned. But once again, I always like to get back to the thought that, you know, individual sectors, individual industries, individual stocks don't move in line with the market all the time. Giving you an excellent example, over the last 12 months, if you just look at the sectors contained in the S&P 500 index, the financial sector is up 25% over the last 12 months, and that's the market cap, you know, part of the S&P 500 index. Utilities and energy are at the bottom at 7 or 8, and that gives you a pretty good example of how things work through time. You know, the market doesn't move in a monolithic fashion unless you have, you know, really big declines, like the 2008 crash. Nothing really survived that particular event. But if that doesn't occur, and we don't think that is necessarily going to be the case, you know, without something really significant blowing up around the world, that, you know, we think the risk is going to be relatively normal going forward, you know, in terms of market volatility.
All right, John. We did have one question that came in that we really didn't address, and the question is, what's going to happen to the estate tax in 2013? Let me take that one.
Yeah, you take that one.
I'll take that one. As most of you know, in this current year, 2012, the current estate tax exemption is $5.12 million per person, which a couple could shelter $10 million in an estate without any tax. In addition to that $5 million per person exemption, we have a portability clause that says if a spouse dies without any assets, then their exemption of $5 million passes to the surviving spouse, which is a nice tax planning catch, because in the old law, you had to have a tax-wise will. So that's the current law, $5.12 million per person, with the portability of the exemption amount going to the surviving spouse. As it stands now, the current law, on January the 1st of 2013, the exemption goes back to $1 million per person. And also the top marginal tax rate, estate tax rate, goes back to 55%. And there's no portability currently in the current law. So you're going from $5 million to $1 million per person, and you're going from a 35% top tax estate tax marginal rate to 55%. So it's a big drastic, that's a drastic change. However, it looks like Congress is leaning towards leaving the estate tax exemption either where it's at today or going back to 2009 exemption amount, which is $3.5 million. Again, we'll have to wait till the new Congress is in session and see what they do. We hope that'll be one of the income tax provisions will be the first things they do. So the estate tax is scheduled to go from $5 million per person to $1 million per person on the exemption starting January the 1st, and the top marginal estate tax rate is scheduled to go from 35% to 55%. So until we hear from Congress, that's what we have to plan on at this point in time. We're hoping that we will see the current exemption stand or go back to $3.5 million. That looks like what we see in a lot of the commentary we read. John, do you have something else?
Yeah, just one other thought. You know, thinking about investments and you know what you might look at, I guess, you know, currently from an investment standpoint, you know, we've always been pretty big on balanced portfolios for most people because they reduce risk over time and, you know, they allow for a more consistent rate of return. I think now more than ever probably balanced portfolios make a great deal of sense. I know bonds are have low yields. The long-term return expectation from bonds obviously is not good. If you buy a bond now that has 2 or 3% yield 10 years from now, it's probably a pretty good bet that, you know, 2 or 3% is what your return is going to look like. You know, over 10-year periods, you know, roughly the current yield explains about 85% of returns going forward. But, you know, while the return expectations are not great, bonds offer a good offset to the volatility of common stocks. And the other day, for example, when the market index was down 300 points, bonds were up strong, both municipals and corporates and even governments. So we think balanced portfolios are a good way to, you know, go through this particular period of uncertainty with a fairly, you know, moderate amount of volatility. Somewhere down the road, it's possible inflation might rear its head, and we have another bout of inflation like we did in the 1970s, but it seems to be some time off. You know, right now the Fed is, in effect, pushing on a string because they and the other central banks around the world are supplying a lot of money, which at the present time appears to be doing more to just basically stabilize the situation rather than generating a lot of enthusiasm for, you know, animal spirits to take hold and everybody, you know, to get into a borrowing spending mode. And we're just not there yet. So regardless of how much the central banks ease at this point, inflation still seems to be potentially somewhere out there in the future. So we still think bonds look reasonably attractive.
At this point, we'll ask for any more questions from the listening audience out there. Please email them to me. Emil, E-M-I-L-E, dot Corey, K-O-U-R-Y, at HancockBank.com. Any last questions? And I will, again, reiterate, there are some important tax changes coming, expirations, and then a new tax of the 3.8% Medicare surtax on net investment income for certain taxpayers. So we'll be ready at Hancock Bank to help our clients navigate these treacherous waters coming up. And if there's no more questions, Ashley, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay. Thank you, John, and thank you, Emil, for the conversation we had today. It is recorded, so if anybody missed it or needs or wants to hear it again, please just let us know and we'll get that out to you. And thank you, everyone, for listening in, and please join us next time. Have a good day.